You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshi on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
You are listening to African Perspectives, where we view the issues of our day from an African worldview and African-centered perspective. This program is unapologetically African. It is a custom in the African tradition to ask elders for permission to speak, having been granted permission. To our ancestors, whose shoulders we stand on, to our elders, whose shadows we walk in, I greet you, my dear brothers and sisters. In the language of one of the greatest civilizations on this planet, it gave the world the basic disciplines of knowledge of science, math, architecture, music, writing, law, religion, you name it, we did it. The Greeks called it Egypt, but they called themselves Kemet, and Kemet means land of the blacks. I greet you all in the Kemetic language, the word of peace, Hotep. It is truly an honor and a privilege to pour libation because we truly do stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. We're going to use water because water has no enemies. Water is the great cleanser, the great purifier. Everything on the planet that lives, it needs water, from a tiny microscopic organism to a tall redwood tree. We pour water into the earth to invoke the spirits of our ancestors, and we say the word Ashe. It simply means, so be it. So we pour this libation to God, for all that God has done and for all that God will do. We say, Ashe. We pour this libation to Mother Africa, birthplace of all humanity, everyone who has lived, everyone who will live in the future. We all have a common ancestral root in Africa. We pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. I mentioned Kemet in the opening. Kemet was the height, the apex, the zenith of African high culture. But there were others as well, as Timari, Punt, and Nubia. So we pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. We say, Ashe. We pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa, of Ghana, Mali, Songhai, Benin, Great Zimbabwe. Civilizations that were flourishing and growing while Europe was in a medieval or dark age. The University of Sankore at Timbuktu, an outstanding educational institution. So we pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa. We say, Ashe. We pour this libation to the Ma'afa, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the Infakani, the great tragedy, uprooted out of Africa. Our brothers and sisters lay a carpet along the Atlantic Ocean. We're in North America, South America, Central America, and throughout the diaspora. So we pour this libation to our brothers and sisters who suffered the Ma'afa, the Infakani, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the great tragedy. We pour this libation in their honor and in their memory. We do not know their names, but because of them and their sacrifice, we are here. So we say, Ashe. We pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement. If you ever heard me do a libation, you will know that we were not slaves. I repeat, we were not slaves. We were captives. What does a captive want to do? Get free. So we pour this libation to all those men and women who fought against enslavement. In fact, I maintain that some of us are more of a slave today than we were in our initial captivity, because some of us are a slave to vice, to corruption, to drugs, sex, and violence. So we pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement. Gabriel Prosser, Nat Turner, Dingmark Vesey, Harriet Tubman. We always resisted, and we will always resist. So we pour this libation in the name and the honor of those men and women who fought against our captivity. We pour this libation to those unborn, those young men and women who will once again lead us back on the stage of human history as a free and proud and productive people. We sashay. We pour this libation to brotherhood and sisterhood, together for the union of family. We need each other. We don't have good family life. There's a saying, conditions shape conduct and consciousness. The conditions in our community are bad. The conduct towards each other is not good. Because why? We lack consciousness. And consciousness is more than just awareness. Consciousness is a deeper understanding of who you are historically, who you are culturally. So once we begin to understand the importance of brotherhood and sisterhood together for the union of family. Brothers and sisters, let us all say, Ashe, Ashe.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Good morning, African world. You are listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com, and blacktalkradionetwork.com. And I am your host, Brother Oshi. Hotep family, hope everything is well with you today. Hope you're going to have a great weekend. Hope you get a chance to do all the things you want to do, need to do, should do, must do, can do, and will do. And I hope the weather will be accommodating for you to do it. But if it's not, and even if it is, you might just want to stay in the house, you know. Just stay home and wash your hands. Serious, man. You're listening to African Perspectives. We're here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., 10 to 12 Central, 9 to 11 Mountain, 8 to 10 Pacific, or any other time around the world. But if you cannot listen to this program live, you can always go to our archives at timeforanawakening.com. Look for podcast, click on that, and then there will be programs that are dated and titled. And I want to say they've been updated thanks to my good brother and friend, Brother Kwaku. They look good. Other programming that we have here on Time for an Awakening Media, once again, this program is every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. All times are going to give are Eastern times. On Mondays at 6 p.m., Acres of Diamonds, public affairs programming out of Philadelphia with Brother Wahad from 6 to 8. And then Monday evening later is Conversation Reparations with Brother Jamoke and Sister Lacey. And then on Tuesdays, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10. And then if it's Friday and it's 8 p.m., it's Time for an Awakening. That's right, brothers and sisters. Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Fridays at 8 p.m. this evening. And then on Sunday at 7 p.m., Time for an Awakening once more at 7 p.m. on Sunday with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Two program notes before I end this. Brother Franklin Jones will be back with me on Wednesday, and then he'll resume his programming Monday and Wednesday at 1 p.m., the Black Matrix, or the Black People Matrix. And also, too, Dr. Rogers' program on Saturday at the end of the month. You'll have the young people who do a lot of research, I think, from Howard University. So I'm not sure what it's going to be called, if it's going to be called the Black Reality Think Tank, too. So other programming we have here on Time for an Awakening is The Warren Ballantyne Show every Monday through Friday from 10 p.m. Eastern to 12 a.m. Monday through Friday. And the number to call is 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. We buy black. We buy black. Get everything you need from American African-owned businesses at webuyblack.com. The largest online marketplace for American African-owned businesses is webuyblack.com. Go to webuyblack.com. Africa for the Africans, Brother Bomani Tayemba. He's taken a number of our people. Remember, he had a trip that was scheduled to go last week. And, of course, it has been postponed. And the new date for Senegal and Gambia is July 24th through August 3rd. And once again, it's $3,700. And then his trip to Ghana is next month, the 25th through the 5th. That might be also postponed or rescheduled, let me say it that way, also $3,700. And then in November, African Roots and Culture Tour to South Africa, November 20th through the 30th, $3,700. And then at the end of the month, at the end of the year, December 24th, the January 5th, 2021, Ghana Repatriation and Investment Tour. Once again, $3,700. And then next year, April 2nd through the 12th, 2021, Senegal and Gambia for $3,500. All these trips are very affordable, and they are trips of a lifetime. Put $400 down, pay on it, make it happen. I got a couple of people that are doing such. And so also, too, once again, if you want to see photos of previous trips, go to Facebook.com/Bomani. If you want to see videos of previous trips, go to YouTube.com/Bomani2007. Renoko Rashidi, my good brother and friend Renoko, he's got a trip coming up October 5th through the 16th, going to Uganda and Rwanda for about $4,200. And then another trip right after that, immediately, October 22nd through November 4th of this year, going to Kemet, going to Egypt. So check out brother Renoko. Go to Dr. Renoko, D-R-R-U-N-O-K-O, DrRenoko.com. Great photos, beautiful photos he has. Habesha stands for helping Africa by establishing schools at home and abroad. HabeshaIncorporated.org. These brothers and sisters are doing the work. They are doing the work. Their mission is a pan-African organization that cultivates leadership in youth and families through practical experiences and cultural education, sustainable agriculture, entrepreneurship, holistic health, and technology. And, of course, their big program is the Kashi Project that is going on right now. They are building in Ghana the Kashi Project. So check out HabeshaIncorporated.org. Habesha. The Shrine of the Black Madonna, once again, it is closed. And once they resume, I'll let you know. So is the Medu Bookstore, because I haven't been able to contact him. But I did contact Brother Gazimde Ajamu with the Black Dot Cultural Center. He's trying to hang in there. He has a coffee bar. And, of course, they'll all hopefully be back open soon. Us Lifting Us, the Economic Development Cooperative for our people in the spirit of Ujamaa. Cooperative economics, or as we like to say, family-centered economics. They had their Thursday night broadcast last night, and Us Lifting Us, brothers and sisters, go online to usliftingus.com. Become a member of this co-op. We need to work together. We need to work together. Akabin Institute, Baba Baruti and Sister Yabaruti, educating our young warriors. They deserve to be supported. Akabin Institute, they accept no money outside our community, so we must support them. Make your check or money order out to Akabin Institute, P.O. Box 10786, Atlanta, Georgia, 30310. Akabin Institute, P.O. Box 10786, Atlanta, Georgia, 30310. Also, too, they're having their sister circle and brother circle. In May, it's going to be online. It's going to be, and here's how it's going to go. For the Brothers Circle, make your donation, $10 donation and $5 for the young brothers, via payable PayPal to yabaruti at yahoo.com. Put information in, Brothers Circle, your name, your email address, so they can send you the link, and your phone number. And that's going to be Saturday, May 2nd from 12 to 2. Saturday, May 2nd from 12 to 2. And then the Sister Circle, also be at Akabin. And that's going to be make your check or money order out. To PayPal. PayPal $10 donation and $5 for the younger sisters via PayPal. Now, this is the account that's different. It's yabaruti at gmail. .com. So they have accounting for the different groups. Include in the information, Sister Circle, your name, email address, and phone number. That's May 2nd, Brother Circle, Sister Circle. The Brother Circle, they're talking about common sense security, working with our brothers in our community. And the Sister Circle talks about quarterly African women discussion, topic. Am I my sister's keeper? the Baba and Yaba Rudy. Sanjay Dash, Haiti, Sister Gabrielle Real, she's been doing outstanding work in Haiti, in the northeast portion of Haiti, in the rural area. Sanjay Dash, Haiti, SONJAYITI, Haiti.org. Check her out. She deserves to, definitely deserves to be supported. They all do. Otherwise, I wouldn't even talk about them. The Inye Say Sim of Daily Revolutionary Thought. The Inye Say Sim. April 16th. The free man is the man with no fears. Dick Gregory. For a people at war for the survival of their sanity, compromise and indecision are liabilities which automatically benefit those who seek to divide and destroy them. On this, there should be no confusion, for there is no gray area in war. There is no space for wishy-washy soldiers or those who have misdefined soldiery for an exercise in assimilation, i.e. those who fight the enemy only so that the enemy will let them in. Being a warrior is a difficult calling, and it takes its toll on those earnestly devoted to our cause. This reality can be very harsh and painful. It can become extremely difficult to see the depths of its blood, roots, and breath of its menticide every waking moment. So certainly, warriors cry, we are human. But soldiers take pain and strive, taking great care not to allow it to sabotage the potency of their fearlessness. We know that nothing is impossible for Africans with the will to do what is necessary and a clear sight of what needs to be done. We only need to have a fearless, uncompromising vision of what a traditional African world would have to be like today to give our thoughts and actions that true aim. We have only to return to what already exists inside of us. It has gone nowhere. We have been, are now, and always will be African. No power on this earth can, and no benign power in the universe would ever think to change that. Affirm, I am fearless. Affirm, I am fearless. April 17th. I would not give a pinch of snuff to be married to any white person I ever saw in all of the days of my life. David Walker. Has any strategy employed by Europeans, interracialism or interracial coupling, is a philosophy adapted by those Africans so blindly self-hating that they see becoming or bonding with those who taught them to hate themselves as their life's ambition. In doing so, they hope to somehow conceal from their destroyers who they actually are. They hope to become who they so desperately love. And if that's not possible, they aim to at least separate themselves from which in them they so desperately hate. Shrewdly, their destroyers promote their deluded invisibility in order to keep the self-haters from seeing them for who they really are. Amalgamation helps make vanquished Africans feel more secure, included, if not more, of being one with Europeans. Yet again, it provides an offensive camouflage for Europeans so they will appear as a part of everyone human. By allowing some of them to blend with some of us, they become no longer seen as alien, odd, different, particularly insane, as one person, one nation, of one living a seely, cultural seely, an intensely cultural consciousness. In doing so, their genocidal intent becomes better concealed within the disbelief of others who believe they have become them. No one would ever imagine them trying to kill themselves. What better defense? Affirm, my bed is undefiled. Affirm, my bed is undefiled. April 18th, we must get over the plantation pride about the number of Negroes in the big house. Albert Klieg, the Shrine of the Black Madonna. In such a comical but sad sight to watch people who are thoroughly ignorant of their own our historical genius, so determined to be accepted by those they now consider their superiors, that each approximation of them they achieve is worthy of commemoration and gives reason for great pronouncements and celebration. The illogic is simple. In our pride celebration of Black First, we applaud Africans for finally repeating or building on the accomplishments already done by Europeans. I got to stop because this is a great one because I agree. I'm hating. And even to this day, 2021, there still is a first to do this and that. And well, let me get finished with this. We act as if we began here, not even pretending that subjugation is not our immediate and total assimilation and disappearance into whiteness, not our ultimate goal. While this criticism is not designed to negate the genius of any of our accomplishments here and anywhere else, it should force us to place them in the context of tens of thousands of years of magnificence. We must measure ourselves in this lazy reality against the time when we were uncompromised, God-like spiritual beings. So to now take pride in what we have finally accomplished is ludicrous and self-demeaning at best. Taking pride in advancement is one thing, but celebrating those who are the first at being at least of those of who we are is quite another. Those most honored for being the great imitators of those who have attempted to reduce us to less than who we are and should be gives us nothing to celebrate. Affirm, I take no pride in the glorification of Negro favorites. Affirm, I take no pride in the glorification of Negro favorites. The Inye Sasim of Daily Revolutionary Thought. Baba Barudi. Brothers and sisters, we have a great program tonight, We have a great program today. We have with us as my guest, as I said to you on Wednesday, a gentleman who I met in Venezuela when we were there to talk about the impact of imperialism, colonialism, racism, capitalism on people around the globe and what prevents a lot of people from not reaching their full potential. His name is Brother Paul Pumphrey. Paul Pumphrey's out of D.C. He is an organizer and activist for over 40 years, and he's the co-founder of Sisters and Brothers International. And he has many organizations, the Friends of the Congo. But you know what? I would rather have this brother tell you what's up and what's happening because, man, I'm impressed when I first met him. And I could see he was an old warrior who's still in the fight. That's why, to me, he's a great example of what an esteemed elder is in our community, because his spirit is still good, it's still strong, he's still like a young man, and he has done so many things. Brother Paul Pumphrey, are you there?
Yes, I am, my brother. Good to be here with you.
Well, it's an honor, man, believe me, to have you on the program. Welcome to African Perspectives. And I hope we have a lot of callers today. I see some are lining up for all the questions they can ask of you. Is Brother Eric Reed with you?
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Hello.
Welcome, my brother.
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Well, great. It's a pleasure, man. It's a pleasure for both of you guys being here. As I said, I met Brother Paul Pumphrey in Venezuela. And some of the things that we were talking about, I was blown away at some of the stuff that this brother has been involved in and what he is doing in a number of areas. A Pan-Africanist, a strong believer in Africans doing for themselves and so forth and controlling their resources and controlling their land, you know. Talk to me about the Friends of the Congo when you started that organization, and also to the other organization, Brothers and Sisters International.
Okay, thank you, my brother. As you said, I have come from a long history of being involved with our community. I actually started believe it or not, at the age of 9, and that was back in the 1950s. In our struggle, one of the things I begin to realize is that we have to focus also, as we deal with our political struggle, we also have to deal with our economic struggle. And too often, when we approach the economic struggle, we latch on to the propaganda that has been taught to us by the United States imperialists on the idea that we now must become the mini capitalists for them and end up finding ourselves in similar roles of actually exploiting our own community as a means of saying that we're being successful. I started off working in the civil rights movement as a child, and later on in the early 70s was a member of an organization called the Black Panther Party, and then moved on to work with organizing migrant farm workers in the state of Florida back in the mid-70s. And then what happened was that in 1975, I was recruited by an organization out of South Africa to help start an anti-apartheid movement in this country. And so I became the co-founder of the Anti-Apartheid Movement USA. And from that, I got involved with going around speaking on college campuses and communities, at churches, anywhere the people were willing to listen to the story of what was going on in Southern Africa. And I had often with me representatives, the UN reps from the different liberation movements out of South Africa, Namibia, and Zimbabwe. And as we went around explaining, I was explaining U.S. involvement in those countries, and they explained their struggle against the regimes in their own particular countries, people became more aware of what was happening in the Southern African countries and began to start creating political organizations to put pressure on the U.S. government to change its policy as it was dealing with the apartheid regime of South Africa and Ian Smith's regime in Zimbabwe. And at that same time, there was a battle going on in Angola. There had been a battle going on in Mozambique with the Portuguese colonies. And what most people have a tendency sometimes not to do is to connect dots. Worked this all in looking at trying to connect dots.
Right on.
And in connecting dots, I began to realize the more I studied about Africa, the more I studied that the U.S. government and U.S. corporate interests has been involved with Africa for over 125 years. In fact, when the Berlin Conference of 1884-1885 took place, where the European countries divided up Africa, clearly the United States played a major role in that conference, even though they weren't a voting participant. The United States had realized that the Congo had a number of wild rubber trees. And the United States, being that they were just recently developing the auto industry, had a great need for rubber. But the U.S. also recognizing that there was no way that the European countries were going to allow the United States to come to that conference and claim a large portion of Africa. And so they cut a deal with the king out of Belgium, King Leopold II, to request the land of the Congo Free State for that of his own personal property. And then the U.S. lobbied to see that he did get that piece of property, and the conference agreed to let him have it. And afterwards, the United States turned around and demanded that King Leopold, in response, should sell them large quantities of rubber to meet their rubber demand with Ford's car manufacturing. And so that was the motivating force that pushed King Leopold to demand that the Africans working in the wild rubber plantations must meet their quotas, because the quotas they were trying to meet was the U.S. corporate quotas for their automotive industries.
So then they cut off all them hands and all those other limbs
to help meet the quota for rubber for Firestone and Goodyear and so forth in the U.S.
Exactly. That was what it was all about. So the United States has been involved, clearly involved, inside of the Congo over 125 years ago. And so, but the United States loved to play the role of being behind the scenes because they don't want to tarnish their image of being the so-called country that supports democracy and justice. Now, look at another example when they had the Sharp Streets Massacre in South Africa in 1960. Most of the European companies that had invested in South Africa got nervous and started pulling out, figuring that once the world found out about the Sharpeville Massacre, that they would start withdrawing their financial support to the regime, and the regime would be doomed. After all, it was way outnumbered by the African people living in South Africa. But the United States banks and U.S. corporations immediately filled in the gap that was created when the European companies pulled out of South Africa. And after the European companies seen the United States moving in and capitalizing on what they had began to develop inside of South Africa, they came back. So the life of apartheid was extended for a number of years because of the United States corporate greed in coming in and actually aiding and abetting the apartheid regime of South Africa back in 1960. Now, the thing we must also ask ourselves the question is the role of our media. And how is it that our media, in fact, is so much involved in distorting what is going on in the world around us? Because we have to ask ourselves the question, how is it that apartheid started in 1948? And for the most of people in this country, they knew nothing from their history books to their newspapers to their TV. Anything really about apartheid until the 1980s. And that was only after we had begun to start educating the public around the issue of apartheid in the late early 70s and all the way up to the 80s and 90s. And that's because there is a direct relationship to who pays for our media. I mean, after all, we look at CNN every day, and it's an industry that makes billions of dollars a year. But how much of that's coming directly out of our pockets and not coming by way of corporate money paying for advertisement? So you begin to start seeing that the reason why a lot of times information is distorted, twisted, and used in a way that benefits large corporations is because they're the ones paying for the news media to give us our information. And you hear people actually getting tricked into saying, oh, well, I watch MSNBC. Or I watch ABC, or I watch CNN. But the bottom line is, you're not paying CNN directly. It's corporate dollars through the advertisement that makes their billions of dollars. And so they're going to serve that interest of these corporations that are paying their bills. So we have to step back and begin to recognize the value of programs such as your own to bring out the real truth of what's going on in this world today. Because if we depend on a Rachel Maddow or, you know, somebody on CNN or somebody on ABC or CBS or Fox News for that matter, then we're going to basically get the image that the corporate world, who are robbing the African world, wants us to have. And we have to, again, connect those dots and recognize that these news organizations are not our friend. They actually work against our interests. So my background has been that of pushing for change, pushing for justice, both here at home, as well as through Africa, as well as through the Caribbean. I got involved with Haiti back in the 70s, but actually got an opportunity the first time to go to Haiti in 1990s. And in the 1995, I helped organize a delegation that we went down to Haiti. This is after Aristide had been returned in 94 from a military coup that took place in 1991. And here we are moving them out in Haiti, and you got U.S. military troops there, Canadian military troops, and French military troops with roadblocks and banks along this line. And our delegation asked us, what was the possibility of us meeting the U.S. ambassador? That was clearly not on my list of places to show folks around Haiti. But we set the meeting up, and we went to it. And as I'm listening to the ambassador answer questions to the delegation, it became clear to me that this guy was more than a U.S. ambassador. And I encourage your listeners to Google this guy's name. His name was William Swing. Now, this is 1995, June of 1995.
25 years ago.
Yes.
Now, what is his name?
I put my hand up and asked him a simple question. What was his history with the State Department? And as he started rattling off the different stations that he was working in the State Department as a U.S. ambassador, it became clear to me this guy was CIA. Now, why would I say that?
Now, what did you say his name again is? What is his name? William what?
William Swing, S-W-I-N-G. And I encourage you to Google his name because this history is on the Google. He was in Libya when there was a military coup. Then he left Libya to go to South Africa. And it's important to understand why the United States wanted him in South Africa. Because this is in 1991 when they knew Nelson Mandela was coming out of jail. And they wanted him there to make sure that there was no way that the African National Congress would ever implement the South African Freedom Charter. And I encourage you to Google that as well. Read the South African Freedom Charter.
The South African Freedom Charter.
Why did they not want this to happen? The reason why they didn't want that to happen was because they were talking about nationalizing all the mining industry, nationalizing all the banks inside of South Africa, and using that money to provide housing, health care, and education to the African people of South Africa. So how did he go about stopping Nelson Mandela from pushing the implementation of the South African Freedom Charter? And this was something that was created by the people of South Africa back in 1955. He came in and told the apartheid regime that was still in power at the time to spend every penny and every dime in the national budget so that when they turned the government over to Nelson Mandela, he would have one of the most sophisticated militaries in all of Africa, and he couldn't pay a penny to a teacher, to a policeman, or to the military. Making it very clear that if he came to power and he couldn't pay them, there was going to be a whole lot of bloodshed. And that's how the United States used this guy's position to undermine South Africa today. And then from South Africa, he goes to Nigeria. And if you look at the years he was in Nigeria, that was when Abacha carried out a military coup. And then he leaves Nigeria and goes to Haiti right after a military coup is ended. And RSC comes back into Haiti. And in 1998, when I was in Haiti, I asked one of my Haitian brothers, what was up with William Swing? And he told me, oh, he's not there anymore. And I'm like, what? Where is he? And they said, oh, he's in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And my first response was, the Democratic Republic of Congo is going to be in trouble. If this guy is going to the Congo, then it's another assignment by the CIA. And sure enough, in 1998 was when the United States started the second war inside the Congo. The first one was to get Mobutu out of power, in which they started in 1996. And to enable the United States, again, to work through a third party or third parties to get their interests achieved, they used a guy by the name of Paul Kagame back in 1990, who at the time had lived in Uganda since the age of three, to use his skills in the military of Uganda to start attacking across the border into Rwanda. And then when Bill Clinton comes to power in 1993, what he does is he acts as if he's trying to bring about peace in that region
So he calls for a peace negotiations with the government of Uganda, and I mean the government of Rwanda and the government of Burundi, along with the so-called rebels, which included Paul Kagame, to meet over in Tanzania and to discuss a peace agreement, which the president of Rwanda at the time and the president of Burundi, U.S. send them a plane, they get on the plane, and they fly to Tanzania to have this meeting. But what the media doesn't spend much time telling us about is that as those two presidents were flying home, a USAM missile blows that plane out of the air and kills both presidents. And that's what led to the Rwandan war. A war, again, that is highly distorted as to who did what in that war. The story that the media tells us is that 800,000 Tutsis lost their lives during that war. And that's a bold-faced lie. Now, it's clear that there was war crimes done by the Hutus and the Tutsis in that war. But when you count the numbers of people who lost their lives, it was about 600,000 Hutus who lost their lives and about 200,000 Tutsis who lost their lives in that war. But why was it important for the United States to have the media tell us that it was 800,000 Tutsis who lost their lives? That was to justify any type of crime that Paul Kagame did after that war as being okay. Now imagine, let's think about a country here. If you look on the map at Rwanda, Rwanda is 1/90th the size of the Congo.
Right.
1/90th the size of the Congo. And they've been in a war where over 800,000 people out of about 4 million people were killed. Actually, I'm sorry, out of about 7 million people were killed. And another 2.5 to 3 million people went into exile from that war. So here's a country that's lost almost half its population, as well as gone through a bloody war. And you're going to tell me that this country won 90th the size of the Congo, and less than a year and a half later is going to take on the Congo and overthrow the head of state of the Congo? Of course, that's not possible without a tremendous amount of assistance from somebody. Now, I want to share with you another thing that happened to me. Back in 2006, the Congo had an election, a national election. It was actually the first national election inside the Congo since the 1960 election that brought Patrice Lumumba, the first elected prime minister, to power inside the Congo. Now, of course, when I said that William Swing had gone to the Congo, by 2006, I had to go back and talk a little bit about this William Swing guy, because he had not only moved in 1998, because after this war and getting rid of Mobutu, because the United States realized that the puppet they had put in power after the killing of Patrice Lumumba back in 1961, that he would be too greedy to accept the low prices that U.S. industries wanted for the necessary minerals they needed for the electronic industry, such as coltan and such as things like cobalt for the batteries, and the tin that they would use to make the cell phones. So they were pushing for Mobutu to get out of the country, and they pushed him out by force with the help of the army of Uganda and Rwanda. Now, an interesting question is, how does a small country, after being in a major war, such as that of Rwanda, and Uganda not much larger, take on such a huge country and travel from the eastern part of the Congo and make its way to the central part and moving in towards the capital, which is in the western part of the Congo, talking something close to 1,800 miles. I found that answer out in 2006, because after I observed the election in the Congo, I went to South Africa. And from South Africa, I went over to visit my friend in Namibia, Theo Bengerer, who was the representative for SWAPO at the UN And after Namibia got its independence, he became their first foreign minister. Then he became their prime minister. Then he became the Speaker of the National Assembly. And as I'm meeting with Ben, I share with him that I had just come from the Congo. He said, funny you should mention the Congo. Let me tell you what happened in 1998. And what happened in 1998, I assume, very good chances the same thing happened in 1996. He said in 1998, after they had brought to power in 1996 war against the Congo, a gentleman by the name of Laurent Kabila to be the president of the Congo, it took about maybe 8 months to a year, and Laurent Kabila became aware of the fact that Uganda and Rwanda were stealing more minerals out of the eastern part of the Congo, taking it across the border to their country and selling it on the international market than he was selling, his country was selling on the international market. And he said, no, this can't happen. So he invited the military of Uganda and Rwanda to leave the Congo completely, even though those were the two militaries who brought him to power. So in 1998, the United States decided, evidently, to get rid of him. And this is why William Swing was sent over as the ambassador to the Congo. Now, I really want your audience to pay attention to these facts. So he gets into the Congo in 1998, and mysteriously, Ugandan Rwandan troops make it from the eastern part, eastern border of the Congo to the central part of the Congo, where basically there are no roads. So they have no air force. How does these troops make it from the eastern border of the Congo, in which the Congolese troops were lined up along that border so they didn't march across the border? But they mysteriously end up in the central part of the Congo. And when they did that, Laurent Kabila was clear there was no way that his troops, who were still on the eastern border, could get between these two armies and getting at him, who was located inside of Kinshasa in the western part of the Congo. So he gets on the phone, and he talks to the presidents from SADC. Well, so he talks to Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, and he talks to Sam Nujoma from Namibia, and he talks to Santos from Angola, asking for military assistance. Now, Ben told me that in 1998, he was in the capital of Zimbabwe when that message came into Zimbabwe. And he said within a half an hour after that message got into Zimbabwe, Zimbabwe Air Force were leaving Zimbabwe on its way to the Congo to give support to the government of the Congo against these two invading armies. He then immediately went back home to to Namibia, and his troops also entered that war inside of the Congo, protecting the sovereignty of the Congo, as well as the troops came in from Angola. And it took them about 2.5 weeks to defeat these two troops, one from Uganda, the other one from Rwanda. Now Ben and the foreign minister of Zimbabwe are trying to figure out, okay, now what are we going to do with these troops? Because under international law, we're responsible for them until they go back to their home base. And while they're meeting on this, here comes a phone call from a woman by the name of Madeleine Albright.
Madeleine Albright.
Yes. Who happened to be Bill Clinton's Secretary
right.
of State.
Right.
Calling the Foreign Minister of Zimbabwe, asking for air rights so the United States can send the transport planes back into the central part of the Congo to pick up the troops they had dropped off. So if people are sitting back here talking about, oh, you know, it's terrible about how all these people are dying in the Congo, think about it now. The U.S. government is flying troops into the Congo to carry out a war so they can rob the minerals. And I must mention the fact that the Congo had about $21 trillion, not billion, but trillion dollars worth of minerals in the eastern part of the Congo that the U.S. wanted to control, because that would make the difference as to who, what country in the world would be dominating the electronic industry, which basically means what country in the world would dominate world economy.
Wow.
So watching these steps And again, connecting these dots help me understand what U.S. imperialism is about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not about anything positive for African people. It's about robbing us. It's about killing us. Now, why am I talking about killing us? From 1996, when the Ugandan Rwandan troops came into the Congo, until 2006, the United Nations estimated that the Ugandan Rwandan troops killed at least 6 million Congolese. Let me repeat that. From 1996 to 2006, it's clear estimation that at least 6 million Congolese were killed. And out of that 6 million, 3 million of them were children below the age of 5. Now, why is all this mass slaughter going on? It's a very simple answer. The minerals that the United States wants access to and that Europe wants access to, people have villages on top of. So how are you going to ask for permission to set up a mining operation where there's a village? So it's a process of extermination going on in the Congo. And that extermination is going on till today.
That's right. Well, listen, Brother Paul, you're gonna hold that because we're about to take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about the cocoa farms that are happening and your involvement in that, and of course Eric Reed's involvement in that, other issues affecting us, and also talk about, you know, at this present day, where we are in terms of Pan-Africanism, unity for African people. What is happening on the continent? Because we are at a very critical time. You know, as Dr. Clark said, we have no friends nowhere. We have no friends. And we need to be a friend amongst ourselves and each other. This is a direct, desperate call for us to have African unity. My mantra on this program, even though it is, we talk about independence, self-determination, liberation, and sovereignty for African people. That's what we do talk about on this program. But my mantra is Pan-Africanism or perish. That's Dr. Clark's phrase, Pan-Africanism or perish, or unify or die. And that's critical for us as African people. If we don't, it's over if we don't. You know, in fact, people talk about the mistreatment that is happening to Africans in China and anywhere else in the diaspora. The only thing that'll solve that is African unity, African unification, Africans coming together, Africans on the continent, Africans in the diaspora. I just listened to a sister, former ambassador, Dr. Anakana, listen to her just the other day, you know, making her plea. In fact, getting all up into the President Xi of China, you know, asking what's going on, you know. So there's a lot of issues. So we're going to take a break. When we come back from that break, we'll deal with more of these subjects. Thanks for holding on to those callers. We'll get to you when we come back from the break. Brothers and sisters, you're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com, and blacktalkradionetwork.com. Very great conversation with my good brother, Brother Paul Pumphrey, and Brother Eric Reed. You'll hear him and talk about the cocoa. You stay with us. We'll be right back.
You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshie on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
There's been so many things that's held us down, but now it looks like things are finally coming around. I know we've got a long, long way to go, and where we'll end up, I don't know. But we won't let nothing hold us back. We're putting our show together, we're polishing up our act. Trying to make it, they only push you aside. They really don't have nowhere to go. Ask them where they're going, they don't know. But we won't let nothing hold us back. We're gonna put our show together, gonna polish up our act.
Nothing, nothing.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. Once again, you're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. That was McFadden and Whitehead. Ain't no stopping us now. So let's keep on going, brothers and sisters. Once again, I'm here with Brother Paul Pumphrey. And as I stated, he's an esteemed elder. His brother has done some tremendous work on behalf of our people and continues to do so. Unlike some brothers, you know, and sisters, they get up in the age and I just want to chill out. I understand that too, but there's a lot of work that truly needs to be done. And Brother Paul has definitely been doing it. Talk to us about the Coco. Oh, he's off. Talk to us about Brother Reed. Are you with me?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah. Talk to us about the cocoa farm that you are planning and the product that you're going to produce. Because let me say this. When I was in Ghana the second time, and I'm sitting in a cocoa farm, and it's huge, and I'm thinking, wow, you know, here's the base of it, but yet there's no production. And that was what bothered me about being in Ghana, and that was 20 some years ago, and it's the same way today. We don't produce nothing. There is no production. You know, even when I saw all those people on the streets that were selling, you know, some of those sisters, man, with great balance, that stuff on their head, they just walking around, moving about. And there was one sister selling peanuts, didn't drop a damn peanut that was on her head in that trade perfectly. But I'm saying is that there's no production. And what we need as African people is aside from everybody getting raw materials from Africa and taking them back to their country, whether it be China, Japan, Europe, and America, and then making finished products, sending it back to us. We need to produce what we want. And so talk to us, Brother Reed, about that.
Sure. No, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. It's an honor being on the show. When you speak about cocoa, we have to understand that 70 to 75% of the world supply of cocoa comes from West Africa. Now, on the same token, we have to also understand that cocoa is not an indigenous crop in West Africa. It was actually brought in all through colonialism and slavery. Now, you did mention the fact that we need to be producing, right? But I think we got to take a couple steps back, and the steps that we need to take back is, I think our educational system in West Africa is flawed, because its architect stems from colonialism, right? Now, if we produce 70 to 75% of the world's supply of cocoa, the question then becomes, what are the educational structures in West Africa that teaches the value chain of cocoa? Right? I can attest to the fact that absolutely zero. There is no education on the cocoa value chain from an elementary to mid-grade to high school and through college. Okay? So in order for us to have an impact in processing, we first need to begin educating West Africa on its value chain. So there's a lot of things that we hear on radio, on TV, and obviously on an international platform, you see how the confections of cocoa has become and have been very popular, right? Just to put things in perspective for you, when you take Belgium and Switzerland, which are the capital of chocolate confections, and you combine both populations, the combination of those two populations are less than 20 million people. But they are the capital of chocolate. Now, you take the population, let's take, for instance, Nigeria, we're talking about almost 200 million people, right? And yeah. Nigeria is the fifth largest cocoa producer in the world, behind Ivory Coast is number one, Ghana number two, right? So what we are doing as a company, and the name of my company is called Spangbola Chocolatier, okay? We originated from the Dominican Republic. My wife and I, we both own over 450 acres worth of cocoa farms, and we vertically integrated our own cocoa beans into our own manufacturing production and into our own retail shop, meaning that we are vertically integrated from soil to table.
Right on.
Okay?
I say.
So what happens then, and the reason why I stress the vertical integration, is because we don't have to ask permission to have our products on anyone's shelves. We have our own boutique where we sell our own products. We have our own online store where we sell our own products. Okay? We've been in business for a little bit over 10 years. Now, based on our philosophy and based on the capacity building that we have built for ourselves over the years, we have a serious responsibility to the industry, right? And that responsibility is that cocoa farmers should not continue to live in a cycle of poverty. Whereas cocoa farmers are receiving less than 50 cents a pound for their beans, right? And the multinational companies are receiving millions upon billions of dollars worth of value with their final confections. And to put it into perspective, if you take it from the bean to the confection, the producing countries in West Africa are losing 6,870% valuation. I'll repeat that again. It's almost a $7,000 increase,
right?
Valuation from the bean to the confection. There's something drastically wrong with that picture.
I say, you're right.
In 2013, we built a partnership with the government of Ondo State of Nigeria, where the then governor, Governor Olusegun Mamiko, was in Maryland in the United States, and he found out about Spangbola, came and visited us, and when he saw our production and he saw the things that we were doing, he leaned to me and he said, "This is what I want for my people." So we've been working in Nigeria since 2013, vertically integrating a 2,000-hectare farm, cocoa farm, into its own manufacturing facility. It's about 15,000 square feet. And establishing its own chocolate academy to begin teaching the younger population on true valuation of cocoa, leading to the new 21st century chocolatiers and chocolate makers of the world that are going to be coming out of Nigeria and all of West Africa, right? So I say all this to also emphasize that none of this works if we don't also own the market, okay? So when I say own the market, it's great that we go into production, but if you don't have market access for your products, and again, today we're speaking about cocoa, but it really, if you look at our entire value chain of products that are coming from West Africa, from spices to fruits, you know, vegetables,
mm-hmm.
if we don't have market access, we're just as good as dead. Okay, it's one thing to have local consumption and reduction of importation of goods because you're having an increase of production in country and in country consumption, but you also want to attract forex. You want to attract foreign exchange. And the way to do that is to be able to dominate the global market. Well, how do you get to dominate the global market, right? You dominate the global market because you weigh in and you lean on Africans throughout the world, people of color throughout the world. Get them to recognize that the products and services that we provide are a much higher quality, better nutritional fats, and these are the products that they need to be purchasing. In the absence of that, what happens is we then rely on the systems that have been put in place to keep us out of the market. And we got to beg them to carry our products. So we need to eliminate that. Hence the reason why my wife and I are vertically integrated. We have our own boutique because we're not going to anywhere asking them to carry our products. We sell our own products, okay? So that's really the philosophy that we have in terms of our business model, in terms of uplifting the farming community and transforming the farming community and bringing them into the wealth. You know, when we talk about how do we really build a sustainable model, and again, just speaking from my expertise and my space, what we're saying is through a vertically integrated process. One, we're no longer evaluating the cocoa beans on what the global market says it is. We're evaluating the cocoa beans based on its true value, based on our own vertical integrated value chain, okay? And then in addition to that, we bring along the farmers by the farmers owning a percentage of the revenues that are earned through every sell of every product, okay? That begins to transform their communities. They move from a community of handout to a community of self-sufficiency. Okay, so great. These are the kind of things that Paul and I are working on, particularly right now in Nigeria. But quite frankly, we have our footprints throughout the Caribbean. Right, we have a little bit of our footprint in Ivory Coast. We're about to establish some relationships in Ghana, in Cameroon, and in Congo. So this is a real serious movement on a commodity that's extremely popular and extremely valuable in the global market, which is cocoa. I actually call it black gold is what I call it, or brown gold.
I see.
But that's basically our background. And if you have any questions, I'm more than happy to answer.
I see. What do you think, Paul?
Well, as you well know, as you've just heard me explain a little bit of my background, when Eric and I met, I saw a clear synergy of how my political work now can also address the needs through economic work. That through what we're talking about doing with cocoa and chocolate, and from that there could be all kinds of other spinoffs.
It's a game changer. It really is.
Right.
It really is.
In other words, it begins to give us the resources we need to bring about the real change that so often we've been talking about for years, but have not had the ability to make happen. That this process that we're doing right now in the chocolate industry is saying, look, we're producing the cocoa, so the benefit of the cocoa should come back and benefit Africa and the diaspora. Because like Eric brought out, cocoa is grown in the Caribbean, in the black African diaspora in the Caribbean. It's grown in Central America, in the African diaspora in Central America. It's grown in South America, in the African diaspora in South America. So here is a vehicle that actually puts, you know, meat to the bone of the ability of progressive movements to really help our communities to become more economic, political, and socially independent, where we now can develop our community as we see it needs to be developed and not be depending upon looking for outside help, which usually that outside help is designed to benefit the interests of the donors of the outside help.
Well, listen,
so I see this process is key.
No doubt, because I think that, you know, when you talk about this product, but there are multiple other products, and particularly the fact that we have the raw materials to make it come about. All we need is the ingenuity, the education, and the machinery to do it. And I know that we can do that. That's part of, as far as I'm concerned, what we're talking about when we talk about true Pan-Africanism, of doing for self, of being sovereign, of being able to be players in the world instead of the pawns that we have been. I'm going to bring a caller on. Caller, 404-453.
Hey, appreciate it, Oshie, man. Great program, man. You got it, man. Hey, look here, my brother. I just want to figure out how to invest, man. You know what I'm saying? But instead of me going over to Africa, I'd rather put my money over there, and then I invest, and then perhaps I take a later trip over there after I get a return on my investment. That's the main thing I want to talk about. But I want to talk about also about what's going on. They got something that have Africans fighting each other. I sit in the ocean. It's called Operation Crimson Mist. All right? And with this 5G coming along, if you look up Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars for my man, me and my man Paul, but you check out Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars and Operation Crimson Mist, and that explains how they're using the best way to take us out and get the land is to have us fighting against each other. So that's their plan they're using. But other than that, I want to find how to invest, man, in that chocolate thing. That's what I want to do. And I got $2 or $3 right now.
Brother Eric or Brother Paul, you want to talk about investment?
Well, two things. I'll speak first, and I'll let Eric come in on that. We are looking at the fact of setting up shops in the Americas, in the Europe, and stuff along this line, because this is where the money is being made. The money in chocolate is being made in a Switzerland, in a Belgium, in a France, in a London, you know, in the United States. And so we are looking for, as we begin to produce the chocolate, we have to have outlets to sell the chocolate within the boutiques. And so it's an opportunity for people like yourself to look at how you will be able to work with us and either be able to run a boutique of your own or to invest in a boutique that you can get some other return on. And I'll let Eric take it from there.
Sure. So Spangola Chocolatier, thank you, Paul. Spangola Chocolatier, it's similar to a Starbucks, but it's a luxury Starbucks, where it not only features chocolate products, but it also features a in-house barista that makes specialized espresso drinks, lattes, mochas, and also has artisan gelato, which is a luxury ice cream. So it is a Starbucks on steroids. We've been operating our shop since 2011 in Gaithersburg, Maryland. And working now with Paul, what we're putting together is we're putting together an investment portfolio. Because our objective is to establish a Spangola Chocolatier shop in every major city in the United States and internationally. Okay? Now, to do that, we have to make sure that we bring in some really good investors, okay? And I want to keep the investment portfolio within the people of color community, okay? So in a nutshell, we're almost wrapping up that portfolio. I would say that you will get the contact information from Paul, because Paul's spearheading that for us. And in very short order, that information will be coming out, because we really want to be doing some serious expansion, particularly because the factory that we're establishing in Nigeria, it will be opening within the next 2 months. If it wasn't for COVID-19, we would be in production right now. But because of that, it has delayed us a bit. And our first production line that's going to be coming out is about 460,000 chocolate bars, okay? That's going to be coming out late this year. And we're going to be doing some promotion on that probably within, I'd say, about September timeframe, and do pre-sales before they arrive here in the United States. Because of that factory that we're establishing in Nigeria, that's going to give us access to more premium quality commodity, which is going to be needed for part of the expansion that we're doing here in the United States. Okay, so we're shoring up our entire logistics, our back end, our commodity, and everything to ensure that no matter how many boutiques we're opening up in the United States and abroad, that we will have sufficient commodity to fulfill the growing need of the business.
So right,
it's in perfect timing, but we really want to attract serious investors that would take this very serious.
So right now, most of the production comes out of the Caribbean, comes out of the Dominican Republic?
100% of it comes from my farm, 100%.
Okay.
But we're bringing along Nigeria first, then we'll probably end up bringing on Ivory Coast, Ghana, Cameroon, and Congo. And then, obviously, we're going to be bringing online also some additional partnerships from the Caribbean, Central and South America. Now, keeping in mind that our product and services is high end, okay? What that means is we just don't buy cocoa beans. We go in and we build an infrastructure of properly sanitizing those cocoa beans, fermenting those cocoa beans, drying those cocoa beans, and then by doing those things, which is called the Cybexo process, by doing those things, that cocoa bean has a higher flavor of aroma and taste, okay? So that then allows us to use those beans into the creation of Spangola products, okay? So again, it's a methodology, and there's a complete philosophy that's attached to this. And when you really look at this entire business model, it's about generational wealth. It's really what it's all about. It's building the entire infrastructure from foundation all the way up so that my great-great-grandkids will have something to build wealth off of. So every investment that you make into this, okay, you're building generational wealth, not only for yourself, but for those that follow.
I had an opportunity when I met Brother Paul in Venezuela to have a taste of that chocolate. It is outstanding. And I love chocolate. It's very good. Yeah. So I appreciate
Thank you.
So we're going to, and for those who are interested, I'll have that information for you. I'll get that information for you. You can always contact me for those who are serious about wanting to invest in Spagnola Chocolate Factory and into the cocoa, into the finished products that are going to be on the shelves and in the kitchens and in the homes of our people, not just in America, but around the world. And that's fantastic. Talking about Pan-Africanism, you know, and as I was looking at what happened in China and what's happening with African people, there's only one solution, you know. There's only one solution as far as I'm concerned, and that is, you know, Pan-Africanism. There's only one solution, and that is unity. And yet, it is very difficult for us to make that happen. And so I'm saying, what's the problem? You got an answer, Paul?
Well, one of the things, again, that we brought up is the fact that the way we want to run our business is a way in which we're going to be investing back into the very communities that are producing the cocoa itself. Meaning this, we're not only going to pay the cocoa farmers well more money than they would be making and selling their cocoa anywhere else in the world, but we also are going to take a percentage of our sales and put it into a development fund so that those farmers can elect a board to decide what do they need to do in developing their community. They may need to have microscopes put into schools or computers put into their schools and things along this line. In other words, the way we're setting up is we're helping Africa to help themselves. And the Africans can help themselves and be able to have the quality schools and other types of institutions that are needed in any society. They don't need to go to China.
That's right.
They have it at home.
That's right.
See, and so this is where we're coming from. We're talking about creating an industry or developing a company that helps oneself, that we help the very communities. And one of the other things that the cocoa industry is well known for is that of child labor.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because we pay so much more to the farmer than they get paid by anybody else, we insist that the farmers must hire other adults to work on the farms with them. They cannot bring children onto the plantation to work. And in that respect, you're now creating jobs not just for the people who are the actual major grower of the cocoa, but also other people in the community who may be unemployed now can make, have income that, you know, that they can support their families with. And so this has a very rippling effect on developing Africa, the Caribbean, and South America, especially the African communities in all those communities.
And see, what you happens know, is, what see what Brother Paul, what happens with this, it's not just this product. When this is successful, it won't be just this product, there'll be others, particularly since Africa and parts of the Caribbean have resources that a lot of times are taken and manufactured elsewhere, and now we can do it ourselves. We can have finished products ourselves to be sold on the open market.
If I can interject real quick.
Go ahead.
But you have to understand also that the cocoa industry has a multiplier effect on other industries. For instance, the cocoa industry relies, the chocolate industry relies on sugar, it relies on milk, it relies on fruit, it relies on spices, it relies on nuts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And all of those commodities are grown in West Africa, Caribbean, Central and South America.
Right.
So the success of cocoa to chocolate is also the success of all of the fruits that are falling now that have no value to the locals, and they just rot on the ground, right? But all of these other commodities start to increase in value because of the chocolate industry.
I say.
And I'd like to bring up one other point. One of the biggest problems you will find throughout Africa, throughout the Caribbean, throughout Central America and South America is that because the agricultural communities have been devastated in their economies, many young people, as soon as they get old enough, they move over to the cities. Now, let me explain what that impact means. Most of the colonial powers put the biggest cities in the countries right next to a port. And by that city being next to a port, it, even to today's world, food is easier, more accessible coming in from the port than it is coming in from the countryside. And so it works against the economy of the country. But when you begin to develop the countryside where people can see that they can make a decent living to support themselves and their families, you will find people moving back out of these overcrowded cities next to these ports and coming back to the countryside to develop their families, to develop their communities, and in fact will boost the economy of the overall country itself. And so by doing projects like this, we're helping to develop the whole economy of the country, because when you have a country where everybody's in the capital city or the major city next to the port, then in fact, it only benefits China, it only benefits Europe, it only benefits the United States, because they're going to steadily be bringing in corn from the United States and other types of things into that country to feed the people, which is very low quality.
Mm-hmm. Well, we got some more callers. Let me take a call. 646-646. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. This is a very interesting conversation. I remember 12 years ago, I did a chauffeuring gig with some Africans from, I think it was Abidjan. And they were opening up a factory in, I think it was Seneca, New York, near Albany. It was an old, I think, Nestle factory that had shut down. I'm not sure if they opened it. I think they opened it. So the opportunity of working with them and listening to them, now this was 12 years ago, I remember overhearing them talking about how European countries basically had total control over the cocoa. I think the farmers was getting such a small percentage of their crops. It was just amazing. And they were saying how the consortium of companies that controlled the whole cocoa industry was just maybe 4 or 5. I was wondering, is that still the case? And are you looking at plants in the U.S. to maybe do some type of processing of the cocoa? And I was wondering, are there any factories still open in the U.S.? Because I know that one up there in Schenectady had closed. I think they had got it and they opened it. I'm not really sure if they did, but that may be some place that you may wanna look at. But I know from the conversations and listening to them that chocolate business is no joke, man. And them devils ain't trying to give that up or lose any type of control. So I wish y'all nothing but the best of luck on going forward. But, you know, you're going to deal with some real serious individuals over there on the motherland because, hey, man, all I can say is from that trip, I was able to go to Africa and see it. And it's the most beautiful place I ever been. And them brothers over there, they live well when they got the money. So it's going to be interesting.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Brother Jay. Brother Paul?
I'd like to pass that on to Eric.
Okay.
Go ahead, Eric.
Sure. Well, he raised a couple of points. First and foremost, I'm not familiar with the company that or the gentlemen that were investing in New York. He did mention the fact that they were taking over a Nestle factory. If that's the case, then they're probably going into some type of mass production of cocoa butter, cocoa powder, which is not the market that we're in. We're in the premium chocolate industry, which really only represents about 2% of the world supply and 2% of the market. But it is a growing market yearly. Ghana and Ivory Coast. They have strict regulations on their cocoa. Nigeria used to have strict regulations, meaning that cocoa farmers have to sell their beans to the government, and then the government allots only a certain amount of licenses to multinational companies to export those beans into the hands of multinational manufacturers, which there's only about 4 or 5 large chocolate manufacturers in the world that control about 98% of the supply. Okay? Now, there's always going to be corruption. There's always going to be roadblocks, okay? But we're not attacking the snake directly hitting them in the head, right? And what that means is that the market that we're in, as I just specified, we're really in this niche premium market, right? The multinational corporations, they're into what we call bulk confections. Your Hershey's, your Nestle's, your Cadbury's. Those are the bulk chocolate bars that you can buy at your 7-Eleven, your CVS, and your regular grocery store, okay? We are attacking this from a pure quality and traceability perspective. We know where our cocoa comes from. We know how it's processed. We make optimum quality product for the consumers to have a nutritional indulgence, okay? That's the market that we're growing. So gradually, as that market continues to grow, we continue to capture more and more of the commodity that was once earmarked for the mass production manufacturing, and now it's going to be earmarked towards the premium market. Now, again, this is not a snap of a finger. This is going to be years and years of work. But as we are building this industry and this following, we are also bringing along the consumers. okay? I'll give you a quick example between our chocolate and the mass-produced chocolate. We have parents that hate us because their kids that are 6 years old, 12 years old, rather buy a $10 chocolate bar from Spangola than buy a Snicker that's $1.99 at 7-Eleven, okay? So the truth of the matter is that we are really starting to change the palate of the consumer. And the consumer's also much more educated than a consumer 10, 15 years ago. Consumers are now willing to look at the ingredient. They want to know calorie counts. They want to know where this product comes from. They now they're even getting to a point that they want to make sure that they're buying products that are not tainted with child labor, with forced labor, and those type of things. So when I speak about traceability, I speak from the perspective that when we start partnering with these farmers, we are also partnering to ensure that their message on the farm meets our standards, which is critical.
I see. We have another call, Brother 602. 602, good afternoon.
Yes, Brother Oshie.
Hey, Brother Marcus.
Yes, good afternoon, and good afternoon to Brother Eric and Brother Paul. You know, it's magnificent news what these two brothers are doing. I am on the same track. The only thing that I am involved in the cashew part component, because as we know, cashew is grown extensively a lot in West Africa. And definitely, I'm probably going to be linking up with you brothers to see how, you know, you can probably give me some advice, you know, because we want to take control of that, because it's the same problems that the brother explained we are the cashew farmers are finding in Africa. They do not allow them to directly export into the U.S. market. You know, these big Nestle's and stuff like that, they block them. So we, by us connecting directly with our people, then we become the distributors here in the U.S. We can distribute a product and then create an economic system for ourselves. And the question that you talk about, Pan-Africanism, one way that I think that we can spread Pan-Africanism more amongst our people is everybody has a phone. You know, every one of our people has a phone, and WhatsApp is a good tool that we can use. We can also, we have to find ways to translate what we are saying into different languages, into Portuguese, into French, because what I'm noticing is, you know, a lot of the Pan-Africanism is in English. So if we can translate it into Portuguese, into French, into Spanish, you know, into Lingala, into other languages, then we can reach the masses of our people, because that's where the message has to go. It has to go to the masses of our people. And when the masses move, the government, they're going to sweep these ineffective governments out of power. So I'm definitely going to be connecting with you, Brother Oshie, to definitely connect with these brothers, because they are on the right track.
Right on, Brother Marcus.
I keep my phone and continue listening. Thank you.
Thank you. Brother Paul.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So, you know, like I said, in talking with you in Venezuela, man, you truly impressed me with many of the things that you were involved in and things that you have done over these many years. And our listeners had a chance to hear some of the things that were happening and your involvement in the history of our people going all the way back into the 60s. And where do you see at this very moment our situation? How do you view it?
I see us at a crossroads or at a fork in the road.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And right now we have a tremendous opportunity facing us, because we tend to want to look at the sophisticated types of businesses and industries to try to get involved in, but recognizing everybody has to eat, everybody has to have shelter and what have you, and that if we're going to work and try to build the economy of Africa, of the Caribbean, of Central America, of the black communities in this country, if we're going to try to build the opportunities for the people in those communities, I would dare say that we need to really begin to look at how do we focus on the most fundamental aspect of what everybody needs. Not everybody needs a phone, but everybody needs to eat. And so if we can begin to develop, because out of, for example, cocoa, we can also, you have to have cocoa grown in a shaded area. It doesn't take a lot of direct sunlight. So that opens the door to fruits. So now you got your fruit, then not only could be mixed in with your candy, your chocolate candy, but also could be mixed in with your ice cream,
mm-hmm.
with so many other aspects. There is, for example, a grass that's grown right now in the Caribbean mm-hmm. that is used for perfume. They pay next to nothing for the farmers to grow the grass. But yet, when they get it in New York, it's $1,200 an ounce.
Mm.
Okay, let me repeat that number. $1,200 an ounce.
Man.
An ounce.
Yeah.
All right. And so my point is that what we really need to begin to look at is this tremendous amount of opportunity in agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
It's tremendous amount of getting back down to the basics. I know a lot of us folks have become city slickers and we
right.
don't even want to think about the countryside at all. But if we want to think about the future
mm-hmm.
of African people,
yes,
we're going to have to start off with thinking about the future of agriculture. Because here you have the most arable land in the world in the continent of Africa. And yet Africa is importing over 50% of its food.
Right. It's crazy, isn't it? Africa could.
This is ridiculous.
Africa could not only feed itself; it could literally feed the world.
Wait a minute. Let's go a step further. The Congo, by itself, can produce enough food to feed 9 billion people.
Yeah.
There's not even 9 billion people on this earth.
That's right.
We're talking one country. See, has enough rainfall and fertile land to produce enough food to feed 9 billion people, and is importing food. We have to understand.
Hey Paul, let me
begin.
Add,
yes.
Yeah. Let me also add that what we also are experiencing today with COVID-19, we are realizing the importance of food security, right? And you know, I mean, we can live without our cars, right? We can live without a lot of things, but we can't live without food, water, and shelter. So when you really look at valuation of things, evaluation of your life, evaluation of things that you're really investing in, we should all be investing in agriculture. You can't eat diamonds, you can't eat gold, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you need food to survive. And look at what's happening now with COVID-19. Everyone is in survival mode. Who knows when this economy is going to come back online? But if you have food, water, and shelter, you know, you can stand out for a while, right? So food security is critical. And the best land, food production, it's in Africa. The best of land are in Africa.
Yeah. And see, what's happened is that the propaganda has been, you know, about Africa, desert, jungle, you know, all of this other stuff that the West has thrown at the world, giving an image of Africa as someplace that is so chaotic and so off kilter. In fact, you don't even hear about, I mean, I know they just had a locust infestation, but basically the weather, the terrain and everything is ideal. It's ideal, you know, for mass production of food for the continent and literally for the world. So you know, the Africans on the continent, almost a billion people, along with the Africans in the diaspora. I've often said that the Africans in the diaspora play a key part, because the Africans, particularly here in America, the brothers and sisters here in America are some of the most technologically advanced Africans on the planet. What if those Africans decided, I'm going to get this education not to beg Caucasians for jobs, but I'm going to get this education to go to Africa to educate our brothers and sisters there, to work with them there, so Africa once again can take a place of prominence in the world instead of being a manipulated, undermined, scrutinized continent that it has been, and for people to come in and take their wealth. And so in all those divisions, because it's not about whether you're a Ghanaian or whether you're a Cameroonian or Nigerian or whatever. We are one. We are one Africa. I would say develop it to respect those traditions that those cultures have. But the first and foremost thing is that you are an African. One of the main impediments that prevent us from realizing that, of course, is the religions that we're involved in, Christianity particularly, on the continent. It's depressing to me when I've been there to see they still looking, have posters of a Caucasian Jesus. And Islam is not better, you know? So, and I'm saying your religion is, you know, is fine. But what's most important is you are an African person. If we're going to take our place in this world, we must understand that first and foremost, that we are one Africa, and throw away all of the, kick to the curb, all the petty differences and religious differences aside, and to work together to build Africa and to secure Africa. Because once we make this move, we're going to have to fight and secure it. Because these Caucasians and others, the Chinese, I mean, they're talking about bringing in 300 million Chinese into Africa. Now, to me, and they're saying it, and that says to me, even though for us here, we must do something, and we must do it now.
And my point I was saying, add on to what you just said, when I was in Sierra Leone, I noticed that there was an area in which the Chinese were supposed to be building a railroad line. And under the contract they had with the government, any soil that they removed, they had the option to do whatever they wanted to do with that soil. Well, from talking to the locals, I found out that they were building a railroad line right through an iron field of iron. So they were digging up the iron, putting it on trucks and taking it to the ports.
How slick, huh?
Okay. While they're having the Sierra Leonean government pay them for the railroad. Okay. The other thing I think we must keep in mind is that when we talk about the importance of agriculture, how backwards is it that you have Europe and the United States and Canada that can only grow food for half a year, supplying food to Africa and places that can grow food year round?
Right, right.
They can do three crops a year, where many parts of Canada, United States, and Europe can only do one crop a year.
Mm-hmm.
And they're selling their food to Africa rather than Africa selling the food to the places that can't grow very much food. And this is one of the reasons why there's such a huge chemical industry for agriculture, because they're trying to increase the volume, since they only have one season, to try to increase the volume of food while depleting the value, the nutritional value of the food. And so we're eating more and more junk orchestrated by Monsanto's and other companies like that,
mm-hmm.
while we could be eating healthy food that's coming from the continent of Africa.
Well, we need to also add in this call the fact that there are challenges in Africa. And I think that the challenges really start with the leaders in Africa. Let me give you just a quick example on sort of how I dealt with leadership in Nigeria. You know, I instilled in them to raise the capital for this project. Because, see, a lot of projects in Africa rely on foreign investment to come in, while their wealth is really kept by a few, okay, and through a lot of corruption, right? You have Nigerians that swindle their money, millions and millions of money out of the country, but then you have communities that are begging for money, right? So I made sure that they took ownership of this project because I want it to be in their hands, and they're the ones that should invest in it. Now, can we bring along additional investment? Absolutely. But after the foundation is built by them, logistics and everything else that are important. So we need to lean on our leaders through the AU. We need to lean on these African leaders to make it easier and safe for foreign investments to come in, right? Because throughout the world, there are plenty of wealthy Africans that can bring money into Africa and build industry. But we need to ensure politically, right, that the foundation has been laid out for ease of investment and security of investment. Because if that doesn't happen, there's always something that's called sabotage.
Right.
And always a multinational company is going to come in and pay off someone to do this, pass this policy, block these products from leaving. So all of those things exist, and we can't fool ourselves that it doesn't. So we really need to really lean on the AU and make sure that, you know, they push policies towards bringing back wealth into Africa and giving us a security of ease and security of operations, which is very critical to ensure the prosperity of any investment that we do in Africa.
I see.
And it's also important that we invest in those communities, that they build the type of leaders that Africa needs, so that, in fact, you have a lot of leaders in Africa right now that are on payrolls of multinational corporations and governments from outside their continent.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why you find, for example, places like Ghana and the Ivory Coast selling 99% of all their cocoa to specific companies and no one else.
Mm.
You know, because they're getting paid. Both of the major political parties are getting paid by these corporations to ensure that they have a lock on the cocoa production coming out of their countries.
Mm-hmm.
This has to change. The only way it's going to change is from the bottom up. So as we begin to do projects like we're doing, and people and communities begin to see the benefits that comes out of doing business a different way, the right way, the more and more it will grow, and people will demand for accountability of their local leaders, of their state leaders, and of their national leaders in their country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only, in my opinion, direction that Africa can go if it's going to survive.
Right. I agree. Well, listen, you guys just hang on, because we've got to close out the program, but just hang on. Brothers and sisters, we end this program like we end all of our programs with the words of Stephen Biko. The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the minds of the oppressed. This program is dedicated and committed to helping to free the African mind, but not just the M-I-N-D, but the M-I-N-E, because under the feet of African people lies all of the resources that everybody wants, think they can't do without, and they sure in hell don't want to pay for. Brothers and sisters, you have a blessed and wonderful weekend. Enjoy it to the whatever best that you can. Stay safe. Help each other. Wash your hands. Shemhotep means go in peace. Esante Sana means thank you. Bibi Fahodia means our victorious destiny. Brothers and sisters, we shall and we will be victorious. Brothers and sisters, you have a great weekend. I hope to see you on Monday.